In United States v. Jones, Justice Sotomayor stated in her concurring opinion, "More fundamentally, it may be necessary to reconsider the premise that an individual has no reasonable expectation of privacy in information voluntarily disclosed to third parties." Now, I've been waiting for the Sotomayor concurrence in Jones to find its way into another Supreme Court decision, and now, 6.5 years later, it's happened. Welcome to Broadcast Blue.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Hello, I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard. In this Supreme Court special edition of Broadcast Blue, we're going to take a look at the recent Supreme Court decision in Carpenter v. United States and discuss the significant ramifications this case will have on law enforcement for years to come. This is a very interesting case with the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts and 4 separate dissenting opinions that total over 110 pages. Primarily, this case calls into question whether obtaining cell site location information, often abbreviated as CSLI, from a wireless carrier constitutes a search that requires a search warrant under the Fourth Amendment. It involves Fourth Amendment concepts that can be complicated, so in order to understand the decision, we first need to look at a few legal concepts at the heart of this decision, starting with the third-party doctrine. Back in 1967 in Katz v. United States, the Supreme Court expanded the definition of what constituted a search under the Fourth Amendment. But in so doing, it also made the definition somewhat vague with this notion of a reasonable expectation of privacy. Under the ruling in Katz, a search under the Fourth Amendment takes place when the government intrudes upon an area where a person has subjectively manifested an expectation of privacy that we as a society are willing to protect as an objectively reasonable expectation. But what exactly are these situations where subjective expectations of privacy are considered objectively reasonable? As a constitutional question, it can ultimately only be answered by the United States Supreme Court. The third-party doctrine is basically a rule of law that developed as a result of 2 key cases decided by the Supreme Court in the late 70s after the Katz decision had been issued. Applying the Katz definition of a search in United States v. Miller in 1976, the Supreme Court held that there was no objectively reasonable expectation of privacy in financial records held by a bank, and therefore the government could compel the banks to provide these banking records with a simple subpoena, and no Fourth Amendment warrant was required. Again, applying the Katz privacy-based definition of a search in 1979 in Smith v. Maryland, the Supreme Court held that the use of a PIN register to record the dialed telephone numbers conveyed to a telephone company was not a Fourth Amendment search, and therefore no warrant was needed to use a PIN register or to apply a PIN register to a telephone account. In response to this decision, Congress passed Title III of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, often abbreviated ECPA, making it criminal to use a PIN register and creating an exception for law enforcement in the same statute with a statutory PRTT order, a PIN register and trap and trace order. And to get this order, the government has to show that the information sought is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation, which is a much lower standard than the probable cause standard that's used in determining whether or not a warrant will issue by the courts. So Congress, through statute, can provide people with more protection than the Constitution allows, but nevertheless protection. And that's what happened with this part of Title III of the ECPA when it came to the use of PIN registers. So taken together, these 2 cases, both the Miller case and the Smith v. Maryland case, Taken together, these two cases stand for the proposition that it is not objectively reasonable to expect privacy in information voluntarily given to commercial third parties. Since there's no REP, since it's not reasonable to expect privacy in such information, then it can be obtained through a compulsory process like a subpoena or a statutory-based court order without a warrant. This is the underlying principle of the third-party doctrine. Up until now, this third-party doctrine was applied as a categorical rule. Generally speaking, what that means is that the rule had broad application to any situation where the government sought information that was in the hands of commercial third parties. The next legal concept we need to take a look at before we get into the Carpenter case itself is the concept of mosaic theory and the Sotomayor concurrence. In United States versus Jones, this was a landmark Supreme Court decision, primarily because it resurrected the old school trespass-based definition of a search as espoused in the very famous Olmstead decision. But there was another part of the Jones decision that raised a lot of eyebrows, and that was the result of what I have nicknamed the Sotomayor concurrence. So just quickly, the facts in Jones so you understand, so we can frame this properly. In Jones, the defense argued that continuous and extended GPS surveillance was unreasonable conduct at some defined point without a warrant. The government had affixed a GPS tracking device to the exterior of this Jeep Cherokee, and there was, under the CATS definition of a search, there was no REP, or it wasn't reasonable to expect privacy in the exterior of a vehicle that was parked in a public place. And likewise, it was not reasonable to expect privacy in the movement of a vehicle on public roads. And so under a pure CATS test, the pure CATS definition of a search, no warrant would be required in order to affix a GPS tracking device to the exterior of a vehicle, tracking it in public places. And so that's exactly what the federal agents did. They attached that GPS tracking device, and they monitored this device for 24/7 for 28 straight days. So around the clock for 28 straight days, they monitored the movements of Mr. Jones in this Jeep Cherokee. And the defense argued that at some point, it became unreasonable to continue to do that without a warrant, without exactly saying where the point would be. But basically, the concept is, the concept is called mosaic theory under the Fourth Amendment. And the whole point of mosaic, it's like a mosaic if you ever looked at a mosaic, right? If you step away and you stand back from the mosaic and you look at all the pieces together collectively, it looks like a picture. But if you get real close and you zoom in, you see these little square tiles, and you can't really see the picture. All you see are these little individual tiles. Well, the whole concept of mosaic theory with respect to the Fourth Amendment is that when the government obtains too many of these pieces of information without a warrant, that these pieces reveal other information that's greater than just the sum of the individual parts. And it becomes unreasonable to collect this mass amount of information about an individual without a warrant. And that is the whole concept of mosaic theory, this continuous surveillance or in the other cases, the amount of data points that are taken. In Jones, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals embraced this mosaic concept and held that the continuous GPS monitoring for 28 days was unreasonable to do without a warrant. And on appeal to the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion holding the act of placing the GPS tracker on the effect of constitutionally protected area was itself a search under the Fourth Amendment, under this concept of the fact that it touched this property, this trespass-based definition of a search that many people thought was overturned by CATS. And so this old-school definition was resurrected, and that created a lot of issues, and we've been seeing a lot of cases based on that over the last 6.5 years. And there were three justices that joined in with Justice Scalia's opinion, but Justice Alito wrote an opinion agreeing with the D.C. Circuit Court, fundamentally embracing the fundamental concept of mosaic theory as applied to GPS surveillance and held that that would be unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And three justices joined in with Justice Alito in embracing this mosaic theory concept, at least as applied to GPS tracking. So it was all up to Justice Sotomayor. Well, Justice Sotomayor joined in Justice Scalia's opinion, making it the majority opinion and resolving the issue on the basis of the physical intrusion and not on the government invasion of privacy under mosaic theory. But in her concurrence, in the Sotomayor concurrence, Justice Sotomayor also embraced concepts of the mosaic theory and specifically called into question this categorical application of the third-party doctrine in the digital age. And she cited both Miller and Smith. And she wrote, "More fundamentally, it may be necessary to reconsider the premise that an individual has no reasonable expectation of privacy in information voluntarily disclosed to third parties." So although she joined in with Justice Scalia, making his opinion the majority opinion, the dicta in her concurring opinion made it perfectly clear that she would rule in favor of the application of the mosaic concept in a search case not involving a physical intrusion. And so since five of the nine justices expressed support for the mosaic concept of a search, it left the door wide open for its application in a future case. Okay, so we've talked about the third-party doctrine, and now we've talked about mosaic theory. There's just one more brick I need to lay in the legal foundation of the Carpenter case before I explain the ruling and its implications for law enforcement. A few minutes ago, I explained that Title III of the ECPA, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, required a court order for law enforcement to use a PIN register on a telephone. Well, in Title II of that same act, in Title II of the ECPA, they created the Stored Communications Act to protect stored electronic communications like email. In this statute, they divided stored communications information into three categories. These three categories are basic subscriber information, communications transactional data or information, and the actual communications content itself. Basic subscriber information would be the basic information about a specific subscriber for this communication service provider. So if you were going for email, for example, if it was a Yahoo account and you had a certain person at Yahoo was the email address, let's say you had subscriber 2011 at yahoo.com, you want to know what's the basic information about this person. Who was the person that created this email address and this email account? And you could get this basic subscriber information without getting to content or looking at anything else, right? This concept of basic subscriber, the name, the address, if a credit card was used to purchase the service, that type of information. A telephone number, any of the, when you go to open an email address, what kind of information do you give them in order to open your email account? And the same with cell phone service, with telephone service as well. So this concept is this, you know, basic subscriber information. Well, there's more to an account clearly than just that. We also have information regarding the way that you interact with your account and the way that it's used. And this is called transactional data or transactional information. And this type of information would be, for example, with telephones, or with cell phones rather, with a cell phone service, the cell service provider, this would include this cell site location information, where the phone was connected, which towers the phone was connected to, whether it was roaming or not, and as it changed from one tower to another, all of that type of information would be considered transactional information. With an email account, transactional information might be the email addresses of people that you are emailing and the email addresses of people who are emailing you. Maybe the different settings that you have in the way your settings are set up in your account. So this whole concept of this second category is transactional type of information. And then the last type, the third category, was the actual communications content itself, what was actually communicated in this particular communique, whether it was via an email or via a text type of on a cell phone. So Congress basically raised the bar for transactional data by requiring a court order called a 2703D order. It's named after the section in Title 18 where it's actually created. So this 2703D order, it was required by Congress in order to get to this transactional data instead of just using a subpoena. Now, understand, without the Stored Communications Act, you could have got to CSLI and other transactional information with just a subpoena. It left the only thing you could get with a subpoena under the Stored Communications Act was basic subscriber information, but they took this intermediate category, this area between more than just basic subscriber information but less than content, and they afforded it more protection by requiring a 2703D order in order to get it, this third-party transactional data, instead of just a subpoena. Now, a 2703D order does not require a showing of probable cause, but it does require a lesser standard to be applied, that the information sought is relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. And we kind of liken that in the law enforcement world, we kind of liken that to the reasonable suspicion, you know, less than probable cause, but more than nothing, right? So cell site location information, the CSLI, is transactional data under the Act. So in order to get to CSLI prior to the Carpenter case, it would have required a 2703D court order based on this lower relevant and material standard. And so now that's the third brick. We've got everything we need now. We have the legal foundation that we need in order to understand, to take a look at the Carpenter case and understand the Supreme Court decision. So let's turn our attention now to Carpenter itself. Timothy Carpenter became a target of an FBI investigation into the robberies of Radio Shack and T-Mobile stores in Detroit, Michigan. The FBI sought and obtained 2703D court orders for this cell site location information, or CSLI, from Carpenter's wireless carriers, Metro PCS and Sprint. Based on the CSLI data, there was almost 13,000 location points that were collected that covered a period of 127 days. Carpenter was charged in federal court with 6 counts of robbery and 6 counts of carrying a firearm in the commission of a federal crime of violence. Carpenter moved to suppress the CSLI, the cell site location information, arguing it was a search under the Fourth Amendment and was seized without a warrant. Fundamentally, Carpenter argued that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy in the CSLI records under this mosaic theory, and that the third-party doctrine should not apply to cell site location information. Both the trial court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals disagreed, holding that the third-party doctrine applied categorically to deny a reasonable expectation of privacy in cell site location information data. The Supreme Court granted cert and agreed to hear the case, providing a perfect platform to test the Sotomayor concurrence regarding the third-party doctrine. In a close 5-4 decision in which Chief Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion, the Supreme Court held that the third-party doctrine could not be categorically applied to cell site location information data, and that it could be objectively reasonable to expect privacy in cell site location information under the concepts of mosaic theory. Chief Justice Roberts relied heavily on the dicta from Jones, including the Sotomayor concurrence, for the notion that it is unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment for the government to obtain this amount of cell site location information from third-party wireless carriers without a warrant based on probable cause. Now, four justices dissented in separate opinions. Justice Alito's dissent was based on the longstanding ability of the government to compel the production of business records. In his dissent, Justice Thomas concluded the property search, which was the wireless CSLI records, belonged to the wireless carrier and did not belong to the defendant, and that the court should reconsider the entire rule of law developed in the Katz decision itself. Justice Kennedy would have upheld the third-party doctrine in its application to cell site location information. And by the way, if you want to understand how cell site location information works, Justice Kennedy spent a lot of time in his dissenting opinion providing a great explanation of CSLI. And in his dissent, Justice Gorsuch opined that the third-party doctrine is flawed because the two cases upon which it was built, Smith and Miller, were themselves a result of CAT, which one surmises he believes was wrongly decided, as does Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas and Alito joined Justice Kennedy's dissent, and Justice Gorsuch did not. So that gives you a quick little synopsis of the dissenting opinions. But it was 5-4, and the Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, it was the majority opinion, and that becomes the rule of law. So what does this mean now for law enforcement? Towards the end of his opinion, Chief Justice Roberts indicated that the decision is narrow and only applies to CSLI and leaves the Smith and Miller decisions intact. Nevertheless, this decision will have at least two major impacts on law enforcement, one in the short term and one in the longer term. In the short term, this ruling means that cell site location information can no longer be obtained from wireless carriers without a warrant supported by probable cause. In many criminal investigations, it has been the CSLI that was obtained with a 2703D order that helped create the very probable cause that the court is now demanding up front. And this means that there may be serious cases that go unsolved as a result of this decision. As Justice Kennedy rightfully asserted in his dissenting opinion, quote, "The new rule the court seems to formulate puts needed, reasonable, accepted, lawful, and congressionally authorized criminal investigations at serious risk in serious cases, often when law enforcement seeks to prevent the threat of violent crimes, and it places undue restrictions on the lawful and necessary enforcement powers exercised not only by the federal government, but also by law enforcement in every state and locality throughout the nation." Close quote. So what he's saying is that the risk that he's talking about is the risk that these cases will go unsolved now as a result of making it more difficult, harder to get to the CSLI, which was often a key part of getting to the point to where we could get the probable cause in the beginning. So as bad as the short-term impact of the decision is to law enforcement, I fear the long-term impact may be even worse. The decision itself may be narrow, but the implications regarding mosaic theory are certainly not. This decision removes the cork that has kept the mosaic genie in the bottle for the last 6.5 years, and by relying on the mosaic concepts argued in Jones in reaching its decision in Carpenter, there will certainly be a wide number of situations open to the application of this same concept. Katz itself was inherently vague, requiring the courts to determine where it's reasonable to expect privacy and where it is not, and leaving law enforcement with uncertainty until a similar case, a case similar to theirs, had been decided. But mosaic theory is even more vague, creating rules that are impractical, if not impossible, for law enforcement to apply. Law enforcement officers need bright line rules to allow them to make split-second Fourth Amendment decisions, and the Carpenter decision has eliminated one bright-line rule and will undoubtedly eliminate more in the future. Well, that's it. Thanks for joining me on this edition of Broadcast Blue. Kept it short and sweet, the relevant and important parts. I'd encourage you to actually read the decision at some point. Like I said, it is over 110 pages, a lot of reading. I've tried to keep it to the nuts and bolts and what it means for law enforcement in this short podcast. If you subscribe to Broadcast Blue, thank you so much. If you don't, please consider it on both iTunes and Google Play. The Broadcast Blue podcast downloaded for you there if you're a subscriber. You can also listen to the podcast at www.broadcast.blue. Our name is our website address, makes it really simple. You can listen to the podcast on the website as well. You can also check out the Blue blog only at broadcast.blue, where we have quick case summaries with links to full decisions on those cases that have an impact on the legal aspects of law enforcement. And you can also link over to our Vimeo channel, which is www.brownbag.video. We have videos that go with many of these podcasts where you can actually look at slides and listen to the audio at the same time. And also sign up at broadcast.blue for the Broadcast Blue newsletter and sign up for the periodic updates and information impacting the legal aspects of law enforcement. As always, thank you so much for what you do, and I hope to see you again here real soon on Broadcast Blue. This episode of Broadcast Blue is brought to you by Lea One at www.lea.one. Here on Broadcast Blue, we provide you information regarding the legal aspects of law enforcement, but if you actually want training on the legal aspects of law enforcement, you should go to www.lea.one and check out their on-demand e-learning courses, live webinar training opportunities, and how they can provide live instruction at your site and live offerings they have at sites located throughout the country. Thank you, Lea One, for presenting this episode of Broadcast Blue. This presentation is provided for purely academic purposes. I'm fond of saying I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. And what I mean by that is that I do not provide formal legal advice through these presentations. No part of this presentation is offered, nor should it be construed as legal advice. If you need formal legal advice regarding any part of this presentation or have legal questions, you should consult with your attorney.